All right, happy 4th of July. Boom, fireworks tonight. I'm John Fox Sullivan. I'm with Atlantic Magazine. I want to welcome you to this session. We've got a fabulous panel. I'm going to introduce Beth Brook, who is the vice chair of Ernst & Young. Beth is responsible for global strategy, communications. I want to honor Ernst & Young and Beth. They have supported this festival from year one, four straight years, and she herself has been here and involved and participated with us. And I'm now going to turn it over to her, and she is going to lead this terrific group.
Terrific.
I thank you all.
Thank you, John, very much. And good afternoon and welcome on the 4th of July. It may seem odd, actually, to have a panel on the limits of globalization. After all, we have spent the last decade talking, you know, just about, you know, how globalization has absolutely no limits. Consequences, yes, but not really limits. And after all, Tom Friedman declared that the world was flat, and we all agreed. And economies around the world have become integrated in unprecedented ways. Emerging economies have achieved unprecedented levels of influence and participation in the global economy, sort of affirming Fareed Zakaria's recent book and as his assertion that it's now about the rise of the rest rather than the decline of the United States. So the reality is, though, is that continued globalization is really far from inevitable. And I think we're seeing that. Economic slowdown, as we're experiencing, can certainly temper global economic integration, and so can regulation or overregulation. That we're seeing national barriers erected by governments, and they're real and they're rising. So, indeed, here in the United States, we're also seeing growing resistance to trade liberalization, and we've witnessed that through this presidential primary season. And throughout the world, we are seeing governments consider measures to limit foreign investment. So it's noteworthy that all of that is going on at a time when actually there's unprecedented economic prosperity around the world. Well, what would happen when we hit an economic downturn? And it truly is going to beg the question for business leaders, the leaders of global business today, you know, what can or should business leaders and thought leaders do today to build continued support for what is going to be needed for trade and for investment and for prosperity around the world? What can be done to avoid the backlash, and what can be done to overcome any limits on globalization? And for the next wave of globalization, is it going to take a new kind of response from the business leaders of today? And if so, what is that response? So we've got a great panel here today to discuss just those topics and to have a robust discussion with you. We will open it up for questions, and so you can feel free to pepper them and pick their brains for insights. With me in the middle, we have Ben Heineman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Science and International Affairs at the JFK School of Government at Harvard. He's also a distinguished senior fellow in the program on the legal profession at Harvard. He's senior counsel. He's got a lot of roles here. He's a senior counsel at Wilmer Cutler Pickering Hale & Dorr. He's the former general counsel at GE. And he has a new book out, High Performance with High Integrity. C.K. Prahalad, to my immediate right, is a distinguished professor of strategy at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. He is known quite well for his book, The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. And he has a new book out, The New Age of Innovation. Chuck Prince, all the way at the end, does not have a new book out. The former chair and CEO of Citigroup, one of the world's leading financial institutions, and also serves on corporate boards as well. A great panel, and I'm going to ask them to make some brief opening statements, their views, their perspectives on the limits of globalization. And I'd ask somewhere in those opening comments, just share your perspective on, is globalization continuing to accelerate? Is it waning? Or is it actually starting to reverse? So, CK, let's start with you.
Thank you, Beth. And I'm just delighted to be here. I think the limits to globalization assumes some implicit notion of what globalization is. So I'm just going to ask four or five ways of thinking about globalization. And you will know, by the way I ask the question, what my biases are. I think it's a globalization, Americanization. If that is so, then there are natural limits. If globalization about multinational companies, yes, there are natural limits to how far that can go. Is globalization about creating uniformity around the world, then there are natural limits. If globalization distorts local responsiveness, there are natural limits. If globalization is not inclusive of all people, then there are natural limits. So the reason I wanted to start that way is how we ask the question begets the answer. There is a lot of discussion on, for example, is globalization good or bad for the poor? That's 4 billion people around the world. If you ask that question, we can take sides quite easily here. Yes, it's good for some, it's bad for some. So I'm going to start with a simple premise that globalization is like gravity. No point in denying globalization, but you can defy globalization and make it more inclusive, make it locally responsive, and that means we have to start with a new approach to globalization, which says, how do we democratize commerce around the world? How do we create the right of every person to be a micro-consumer and a micro-producer so that we create the new framework that is inclusive, that is locally responsive, that is widespread, allows for a tremendous amount of entrepreneurial growth? If you start with that perspective and look at it as the agenda for not next year, next election, but the next 15 to 20 years of democratizing commerce, I believe globalization is both an opportunity for doing good for around the world, increasing prosperity, and increasing interdependence across people and across countries and companies. So that means we have to really start asking ourselves, how do you create micro-producers and micro-consumers? Not just the consumers that we are in this country, but people living on $3 a day, $2 a day. How do we create the ability to get them world-class product and services, but at affordable prices, and create access to all people? I believe that global trade has the ability to bind people together. And for the first time, we have seen the early opportunities. And I'll just say, as an example, the cell phone revolution around the world is quite extraordinary. Already 3 billion people are connected. In 5 years, 4 billion people will be connected for the first time in human history. That is because we made globalization inclusive, we made it accessible to ordinary people, and we took world-class technology and made it available to everybody, whether it's a person living on $3 or a person living in Aspen. So I think there is something to be said from what has happened in the cell phone revolution around the world. People are connected, and with the internet, television, PCs, and cell phones, people are so connected around the world and will be more connected that for us to deny that they will all want to participate in the good that can come out of globalization, I think is working backwards. Having said that, I am not Pollyannish. I recognize that in the short term, asymmetric benefits and asymmetric lags in the benefits of globalization can create political backlash. You are seeing it in the primaries already. We don't even like Mexico anymore, which I think is unfortunate. I think it's going to happen. I think of it as blips. It is going to happen across various countries. I see them as blips, but the overall trend seems to be very clear that we are going to go more towards an interdependent, connected world where globalization would be a lot more inclusive and therefore bring a level of prosperity to all people. But more importantly, I think it will generate knowledge not only in the developed countries, but knowledge from the developing countries which can inform decisions in the developed countries. So I am a very optimistic view of globalization, and I'll stop here, and I'm happy to respond to questions later.
Terrific. Ben, let's turn to you.
I'd like to give a answer to the question from the perspective of a big transnational companies. The top 200 companies in the world have a large share of world trade. They are symbols of what can happen, the good and the bad of globalization. So I think we need to focus, at least in part, in our discussion about those companies. I think that the goal for the companies, as the book title indicates that was mentioned, is high performance with high integrity. And indeed, I would say that is the goal of global capitalism. What do I mean by high integrity? Robust adherence to the spirit and letter of the law, establishing global ethical standards beyond what laws require that bind the company and its employees. And the third element are employee values of candor, fairness, honesty, reliability, and trustworthiness. You all know that no organization can work that's bedeviled by turf fighting, backbiting, selfishness. You need those values to be effective, to get the mission done in a good way, to serve the institution and the larger public. So the goal of these companies ought to be this. Tomorrow I'm speaking on a panel about global governance. I will talk then about the incredibly important role of the CEO and about how misguided the governance debate has been to focus only on boards. But so let me stop there in terms of the broad thesis. What I'd like to spend the rest of the time is on an issue that I think is very central to the future of globalization and indeed is a limit, which is corruption. All the American multinationals and many multinationals now talk about having 50, 60, 70% of their revenues from emerging market countries. But every one of those countries is bedeviled to some degree or another by corruption. And by corruption, I mean in this instance, bribery, extortion, and misappropriation. There are many other kinds of crime, and indeed the bribery, extortion, and misappropriation feeds those other kinds of crime, whether it's drugs or weapons of mass destruction or human trafficking, whatever it may be, money laundering. But I'm focusing on these alone for these purposes. And I think that the major transnational companies have a fundamental obligation to make globalization work without corruption. They cannot solve the problem because, to some extent, the problem is going to turn on each society and its own history and culture and how they deal with it. But international companies can deal with it in sort of four dimensions, and I'm going to try to be very, very brief. One is within their own borders. What can they do to make sure that their employees do not bribe, do not give into extortion? You can create a robust culture through in operations where this can happen. It is hard to do. People raise their eyebrows whether it's real. It can happen. It should happen. It must be led by resources, commitment, aspirations, and action. I can get into more about that later. A second dimension is to support national laws that basically prohibit developed world companies, the supply side so-called, from bribing in the developing world. The United States has something called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is 30 years old. About 20 years ago, when I started GE, people came to me and said, that's hurting our competitiveness because other companies can bribe. I suggested that maybe the way to deal with the problem was to level up, not level down. We formed something called Transparency International, which is an NGO in this area, and we're part of a large group that basically got an OECD convention that required the developed world, Germany, Japan, the UK, Italy, France, to make a law that it was improper for their companies, headquarters in those countries, to bribe outside of those countries, and especially in the developing world. Again, I can come back to this in discussion. That convention has had a very mixed history. For example, things are now happening in Germany and France, surprisingly in Canada and the UK, two of our biggest partners in bilateral relations and biggest trading parts of the OECD. There's been no enforcement whatsoever, a tremendous shock and a real problem. The third dimension is the international financing institutions like the World Bank. The World Bank gives $25 billion a year in loan and grants, which is about a quarter of what all aid institutions around the world give. There are estimates as much as 20 to 40% of that $25 billion doesn't go for its intended purposes, misused, misappropriated, whatever. As you know from reading the newspapers, there has been a lot of controversy about the role of anti-corruption in the World Bank activities, both in terms of capacity building within nations and within its own programs. They have a long way to go, and it is a very big issue in the these IFIs, these international financing institutions, and something much more needs to be done. And corporations can help in all these dimensions. The last, of course, is the developing world. And I won't get into development theory. It's very complicated. I think there is a consensus now. Some people used to argue economic development. Others would argue development of institutions. You truly have to have both. And the transnational corporations have an important role to play by being model citizens in the way I indicated before, no bribes, no extortion, not allowing misappropriation, setting an example in what they do, and also participating in public policy, not just in their self-interest, although their self-interest certainly should be part of it, but with a broader view for what they need. China, for example, is undergoing great debates now about energy versus environment, about the social safety net since the state-owned industries are going down and having less importance and providing less of a social service function. Companies need to play this role, worrying about what the social goods are in helping develop these nations, because they, while they cannot be ethnocentric, they cannot be parochial, they do have a voice that can be helpful in some of these societies. So in these four dimensions, within the company, within the developed world, international financing institutions in the developing world, these transnational companies have a very important role to make sure that they perform with integrity and begin to deal with this scourge of corruption, which is huge, estimated at least $1 trillion by the World Bank several years ago, and hurts development, the poor, the rule of law, institutions. It has many terrible effects.
Terrific. Thank you, Ben. Chuck?
Beth, thank you. I'm sure everyone who comes to Aspen thinks that globalization is a good thing. And I do, too. Citibank has operations in more than 100 countries and has been a foreign institution for more than 100 years. Globalization is a great thing. I'd like to focus on two aspects that I think right now are causing a slowing or a friction point or a waning of the speed of progress that we've seen in the last recent few years. And there are others, of course, but these are two that stand out for me. One is that the dislocations that come from globalization are not uniform in their application. I think this is a little less important than the other one. But as an example, if Citi were to have shut down a large call center in South Dakota, where we have a big call center, and move those operations to India, the benefits of that act of globalization would have advantaged capital on both sides of the equation. The stockholders of Citi would have benefited through lower expenses and presumably higher earnings. And the capital in India setting up a new business and so forth also would have benefited from that act. Labor would not. Labor would have had an asymmetrical impact. Obviously, the people in India getting new jobs, hopefully better jobs, would have benefited. The people in South Dakota, after relatively modest severance payments, would have been thrown on unemployment. And so there's an unequalness, and that dislocation sometimes pops up in a higher way rather than a lesser way. And we've seen that now in some Latin American countries. We've seen it in some Western European countries. We've seen it most recently and most obviously in the pandering that politicians do in certain parts of the country during election years to these kinds of issues. And that is, I think, something which is causing a friction point or a slowing in the rapid pace of globalization that we've seen over the last few years. The second is a sort of a different one, and I think a more important one, and that is that in many of the developing countries, there is a resurgent sense of value. There's a pride that shows up that changes the dynamic between the developing countries and the developed countries as it relates to trade. And the fact that the Doha round didn't go anywhere is partly to do with protecting agricultural interests, but it's also partly to do with this resurgent sense of pride. The fact that the South Koreans are protesting by the millions has partly to do with fears about American beef, but also partly to do with whether or not the government is seen to be toadying to American hegemony. The fact that India can't get through the new nuclear treaty, even though by most accounts it is seen as a very, very valuable, positive document for India, has to do with whether or not the government is seen to be toadying to American influence. And, of course, the benefits of globalization have brought up the developing countries in ways where we have to, I believe, set a new equilibrium between the developed and the developing countries. If in my experience, when you go to an India or China, a South Korea, Brazil, and you talk about the benefits of trade, frequently you will get back, we got more trade than we know what to do with. We don't need to sign an agreement and give up something to get more trade. We're trying to cut back on foreign investment. We're trying to stay away from the inflationary impacts of hot money coming into the country. The need by developing countries to sign up to multilateral deals has diminished dramatically. Now, both of these are evidence of the success of globalization. If globalization weren't having these transformative effects, you would not see these macro kinds of trends happening. But I think it means that for the developed world, and perhaps especially for the United States, we need to be thinking about what's the next chapter look like? What's the new equilibrium look like by which then the gravity effects of globalization go forward, probably positive for everyone, but probably in a different manner than it's been the last 20 years.
Very, very well stated, all of you. And Chuck, you talked about what does that next wave of globalization look like? CK, I heard you say, you know, it's got to look inclusive. Everybody's got to win. Everybody's got to be able to be both a consumer and a producer in a productive way. Let's go back to the backlash issue, though, because Chuck, you raised it, and CK, you mentioned it as well. There's the consumer backlash from poor products. We've seen some of that go on in the U.S. We've seen the worker backlash from worker dislocation. I was in Chile last week, and you know they're complaining about American business coming into there and dislocating local businesses there. So it's not just a U.S. phenomenon of concern about worker dislocation. And it's now in the U.S., both blue-collar frustration and white-collar frustration. I guess, CK, when you use the cell phone as an example and said, look what that has done. And I was struck as you said that by, in those developing countries where the cell phone has had such a transformational effect, there wasn't a fair amount of dislocation created. There wasn't an industry that existed where that technology coming disrupted. It actually was totally additive. I'm trying to think about the next wave where there are local industries, and globalization is disruptive. It does cause backlash. The new products enabling people to be consumers, they're not homegrown companies. Perhaps they're coming in from foreign investment. You know, talk about the backlash. Are you worried about that in this democratization of commerce?
No, I think there is going to be asymmetric benefits, both in the developed countries and the developing countries. And even the transnationals, 200 of them, have to really ask themselves how much of who we are is going to be defined by our country of origin. If IBM, and I'll take IBM because it's not GE, neither is Citi, if IBM employs 90,000 people in India and going up to 100,000 people, who is us? That's the question that Rake asked many, many years ago in one of his interesting articles in HBR. Who is us is a very interesting question for a multinational company. I do not believe countries compete. If countries competed, then we should be in dead heat competition with Finland because Motorola thinks Nokia is the big enemy and it comes from a tiny country. I think companies compete, and therefore there is going to be this continuous pressure for access to talent, access to speed, access to quality, and access to cost. And that means large companies have already become somewhat agnostic towards where they operate, where they access talent. And a call center is a very interesting example, whether it should be, we should be loyal to folks in the Midwest, or should we be loyal to 50,000 people who may be working for you in Southeast Asia. So I think what I think it requires is a different kind of leadership where people start looking at what is good for building a system that protects our long-term interests rather than building something that protects our short-term interests. And I genuinely believe that the suffering that individuals go through is real. Somebody at 55 or 53 loses his job in General Motors. And I live in Ann Arbor, so I know what it has done to Detroit is real. But you have to balance it with somebody who did not have enough to eat and was living on $2 a day, and now he's able to get $3 or $4 a day and send his kids to school. So it is not at all clear to me whether globalization allows us to be very parochial and local interests. So the real debate, I think, for me in looking at what is happening in the primaries is all politics, as O'Neill said, is totally local. But globalization forces the issue on whether we want to be, as leaders, totally focused on the local issues or what we have to see as leaders on what is good for the world.
But what it tends to do is leave the policy making, public policy, in Never Never Land, where
right.
local voters are fueling it. Ben?
Let me give two perspectives. There are two issues. One is the labor markets. And clearly, a lot of the heat around globalization is not about capital, but about labor markets, as Chuck said. I think there's a private answer and a public answer. The private answer is that you have to provide, again, I go back to the transnationals, the big companies, although I think this goes beyond that, good severance, good training, or early retirement. You have to address those as a private institution so that you can invest properly and compete in lower wage markets. Without a question, private companies have that obligation and need to do it. There is then and GE started to do it not just because of globalization, but because of productivity. In the late 80s, the United States was not a productive country. There were lots of stories about how Japan, Germany were going to, you know, be the future and America would never come up. What happened in America in the 90s was incredible productivity due to technology, but also due to restructuring. But in order to do the restructuring, we had to take into account the effect on workers and provide them with, as I say, severance, retraining, or early retirement to take care of their needs, without question. On the public policy side, you know, you really have to, I think, look at the whole unemployment insurance, trade adjustment assistance, wage insurance. You need to look at it as a whole. The jobs, we create enormous numbers of jobs in the United States. We have a lot of churn because our labor markets are much freer than in Europe. What is the right approach going forward? Because a lot of these lost jobs are not due to trade. They're due to productivity and just the normal churn in the economy. I think we need to have a more comprehensive look at all these programs, some of which are very old, some of which are not very effective, some of which, like wage insurance, have been talked about but not yet implemented. So I think that is going to be a real challenge to deal with both the politics and the human dimensions of this issue, but it's an issue far broader than just globalization. Lastly, on supply chain, there have been a number of stories in the past year, sadly true, of terrible failures on the safety and quality in the supply chain. I think, again, since I'm a sort of former manager type, I think the fundamental responsibility, first and foremost, is business's responsibility. It used to be that you had verticalized companies, that you did everything from, you know, you mined the ore to make the steel to make the car. Obviously, we are now in an era of complete de-verticalization, where you're not only sort of offshoring, putting it offshore, but you're outsourcing to third parties. The same responsibility, though, for the end product is yours, whether it's heparin, whether it's toys with magnets on them, whatever it is, you are responsible. You, the company, are responsible for the supply chain. And you better have strong disciplines to ensure the quality and safety of what you are sourcing, whether it's from China, Indonesia, Brazil, Mexico, or Topeka. That responsibility, if you're choosing to de-verticalize, offshore, outsource, remains in the company itself, first and foremost. And there's lots of supply chain discipline, and that's why I go back to this concept of performance with integrity. Part of integrity is having these supply chains that work the right way.
Well, let's talk more about the first point you made in that set of comments, and that was I heard you assert that it is incumbent upon business, the multinational corporation, to pay attention to the needs of those displaced workers, the severance, the retraining, the early retirement, et cetera. Let's take it to a policy perspective. If we're thinking about backlash, and how does business try to preempt backlash, or how does government try to preempt backlash? What's the role of the multinational corporation? In other words, some of the backlash we're experiencing in the U.S. today is the fact that people are concerned about their health care, they're concerned about the fundamental, their pensions, they're concerned about their jobs. And government seems to not be dealing with any of those things. So what is the role of the multinational corporation on those basic fundamentals so that the benefits of globalization can be realized?
Chuck, you want to answer before I?
Well, you know, and it's quite a conundrum. In Western Europe, labor is a constituency of management. In the United States, it's not. Managers are paid to represent capital. They're paid to represent stockholders. And you can have very strong views about, quote, the right thing to do, But the reality is that most of the right things to do have long-term benefits and short-term costs. And that's a hard trade-off in a business today. And I think the top 200, as Ben described them, I think most of them try to do a very, very good job. I think hearts are in the right places, if that's a phrase that can be used here. But I think to have very significant increases in severance policies, early retirement policies that make a meaningful difference for dislocated workers, have very, very significant short-term costs against long-term benefits for stockholders. And that's a complicated trade-off.
All right, let me try to respond. I think from a firm point of view, if you're going to have wholesale restructuring, major things, you do have to sort of bite the bullet and accept that. But there's always a debate, and this is sort of gets into the question of corporate social responsibility. The corporate social responsibility folks want the company to bear the responsibility. And in some cases, that's fine. But in some cases, as Chuck just said, the cost of taking the voluntary act may be so great that it may make you uncompetitive. Let's take Superfund. To clean up the waste that you deposited in the past is very expensive. And it's only fair that it apply across all of corporate America or whichever the jurisdiction is, so that the costs are spread fairly and you can compete by doing it more efficiently, not by avoiding the responsibility, not by being a free rider. And the same probably is true in terms of these worker benefits. Someone like GE with a healthy balance sheet can do a lot, but not every company, large company, can do it. And certainly as we go down the scale in terms of size of company, they may not have the balance sheet to do it. So we then get to the question of a social good, something that's required for the society to protect the workers in some fashion, recognizing that there's always to be competition and dislocation in labor markets. Where's the right line is one question. But then how do you sort of spread the cost with what kind of legislation? I think CSR types don't recognize that sometimes they're really talking about social goods, not about something that companies should do voluntarily. I think companies sometimes just say no to the CSR types, are basically against regulation and government, when indeed the government has an important role of putting a floor underneath certain problems, letting people go above them, accepting the fact that there's a need for social good, and participating in a constructive way in policy debates rather than just saying no.
I think there is a way out. I think if you look at why a lot of companies take their work outside the United States, it's primarily cost arbitrage, but not only cost arbitrage. Many times it's talent arbitrage, sometimes it's innovation arbitrage. But cost arbitrage is an integral part. Let us assume a company saves $100 by taking a call center from Midwest to Bangalore. There is nothing that stops the company to come public and say, we save $100, we put $20 or $25 for retraining a workforce, buying them some insurance, taking care of their health for the next year. So we provide a safety net, and we give 75 back to the stockholders. I don't think we have had the debate. We have assumed managers only work for investors, not for society at large. So we have never really re-energized our thinking on the new social compact that large corporations have to generate. What Chuck is talking about is the need for a new social compact. And I don't think there is a debate that is taking place in this country. I see that debate taking place a lot more actively in Europe. Of course, they start with their own ideological biases, and therefore, sometimes they miss the point. But at least there is some debate. I see a lot of debate in emerging markets like Brazil and India. With all its problems, people are asking the question, how do we create the new social compact? But I think that debate is singularly absent in this country. And I remember Bill Gates gave a speech in Davos on creative capitalism. And before he could finish, everybody was after him saying, this guy's getting crazier by the minute. Actually, I think he's asking that question to be raised. And I think he has done it both ways. So he understands capitalism in its purest form. So I think that there is a need for this debate. And I think this is a good place to start the debate, because I think people are freer here to talk rather than in forums in Wall Street.
Well, there is a need for a discussion around a new social contract. I know, Chuck, you care a lot about managing a company for the long term. Your comments.
I was just thinking what CK was saying about a debate. I'm amazed by not only the lack of debate, but the lessening of debate. I remember in 1992 when NAFTA was such a hot topic, and we had all the debate about Ross Perot and the sucking sound of jobs going to Mexico, and we all remember that. And I remember it particularly because my father was a union official, and there was a great deal about, you know, made in America, and many things were advertised as made in America. And some people would look to buy things that were made in America and so forth. In the current debate, which I find comes up, I'll say unfortunately, but comes up only in election years and only in certain states, in that debate, there is no discussion about made in America. No matter how much pandering there is to laid off workers in the Midwest, nobody talks about made in America. There is no discussion of that at all. And there is a complete disconnect in the public mind between the benefits of globalization and the detriments. So people are concerned about layoffs and so forth and so on. But everybody wants to buy things absolutely as cheaply as possible at Walmart. And they want all of that stuff to be made in Cincinnati. And it just doesn't work that way. And there is no debate about that, that there is a complete disconnect. And I find it a mystery as to how over the last 10, 12 years, we've moved from one level of debate to an almost conscious ignorance of the issues that are involved.
I couldn't agree more. I think back to, you know, remember Japan, and we were all concerned at one point in time about, you know, all of, you know, the manufacturing going to Japan and the bleeding away from America. We no longer think about that or talk about that. But yet we're experiencing somewhat of a similar discussion around China or in our knowledge economy around India with some of the same disruptions and dislocations. You think about what drives business, and it's the quarterly results. It's the short-term nature of performance. You think about what drives politics, and it's the next election. It's that short-term focus. And it is preventing this discussion about the new social contract, the short-term nature of business and the short-term nature of politics. And I am struck. I was in the Middle East recently, and I was struck even there about the depth of discussion between the public sector and the private sector about how they were going to work together on a new social contract for the Middle East and for income inequality in the Middle East. It was the last place I expected to actually to find such a discussion.
Can I utter a little tiny voice of optimism?
Sure,
just a little bit. I think that the
Then I'm going to ask you, where are the CEOs in this discussion?
Okay, but I think it, you know, in the 90s, it was all about shareholder value. If you that was the mantra, and that was sort of the law and economic school, and that was, I think, a very narrow view of, in fact, what corporations do. Most articles of incorporation in states don't say that. They say that the corporations be managed by the directors in the best interest of the corporation. But that best interest can include stakeholders far beyond the shareholders. And indeed, today, I think you will find many company CEOs talking about stakeholders, not just shareholders. It's not just about short-term wealth. Now, do they get killed in the marketplace by the market and by all the different kinds of shareholders we've got for not getting short-term gains? Yes, but they're also getting a lot of pressure from other sides to talk about other kinds of issues. It's a very hard job right now, to put it mildly. But I do think that the dialogue among the CEOs has changed. And one small example, GE now puts out a citizenship report, which is the equivalent of the annual report, but talks about what we do in a lot of other areas. It's 90 pages long. It's got URLs that you can sort of click down into detail. We have a stakeholder advisory group that we meet with twice a year. There is a lot of opportunity for a lot of other people to have dialogue with the company about things to do, and without going into details, and you don't have to believe me because it's somewhat self-interested, but we really did listen and we really have changed things in the course of this process. So I think there is a trend in this direction, even in the United States. The problem is we're in a crunch time in terms of the economy, and it makes these things all that much difference when the quarterly earnings as the stock market's tanking become ever more important. So there's always this incredible contradiction that you have to navigate through.
Is there an opportunity right now, because of this contradiction in this time we are in, for the government and multinational corporations to explicitly work together on some of these broader issues? Public policy created around it, incentives put in place to reward business for the right focus. I mean, is there an opportunity that's being missed because the two aren't talking necessarily to one another?
Yeah,
I believe the opportunity, if ever there was a ripe opportunity, it's now. And the reason is, I think we are confronted with ecological problems, which we ignored for a long time. And at least both the candidates are talking about it explicitly. We have never focused on the inequalities emerging in this country, which is getting to a point where it's not any more funny to have the inequalities. We have 45 million unbanked people in this country, which I don't think is acceptable. So I think there is an opportunity for leadership on both sides, both the public sector leaders, much more importantly, for a young, for a small group of CEOs to explicitly talk about the new social compact. I do not think it's going to happen company by company, one company doing something and the other company taking advantage of it in the short term, because then I think it is the whole issue of who is going to take care of the public good. I believe there is a need for a consensus to evolve through public debate. And I think we are shying away from the harsh issues of asymmetric benefits. And I fully agree with Chuck. We as consumers love Walmart, but as managers and employees don't like it. And I think you can't have it both ways. And I think
we do have it both ways. I mean, that's the dialogue now. We do have it both ways.
That's right. We're trying to have it both ways.
Right.
So I think one of the things that I think would be very fascinating is to start the dialogue explicitly. And I think my sense is even the people who are displaced understand the issues. They want somebody to crystallize it for them, somebody to provide a framework. So the timing is perfect, I think. The change of leadership in the country is a very good time. And I think the circumstances are also very good because we are not going to use the old ways of doing things, which got us into this problem, to get us out of this problem. So in other words, doing the same things more efficiently is not going to help us. We have to do different things. And I believe the timing is right.
I think we probably all agree. I don't know that I would call it a public-private partnership. I think there is a time for sort of major changes in public policy. Let me take two. Healthcare. You know, some companies are just giving up providing health care. I mean, there is a crisis out there. They're paying too much. They know the system's, many corporations know the system's broken. They're prepared, I think, to negotiate and talk about changes, systematic changes in the healthcare system that didn't exist before. So that's an opportunity. But I do think, back to this point of sort of individual companies doing the right thing versus sort of a societal legislative solution, I think it does take public policy on these big issues. That's issue number one. I don't think there's any question. The potential's there. It's failed many times before because the issue is so complicated, but the potential is there to make a change. I think on climate change and energy and the environment, companies are everyone wants to be green. Everybody is for new technologies. Some of these technologies are going to require short-term subsidies because they're not market competitive. Companies are not going to be, people won't, you know, buy them if they're that much more expensive. So whether it's wind or solar, there's going to have to be, and ought to be clearly understood, transitional subsidies which do phase out at some point. But that is a good example of alternative fuels and where I think it is going to be some kind of R&D supported in some sense by the government. But the whole issue of climate change, I think everybody recognizes is going to require a national or even international solution. No individual company is going to. So I think it is a time. I would not call it public-private partnerships, though. I would just say it's a time for rethinking and recalibrating and sort of resetting public policy in critical areas in health and energy or two, and environment too.
I'm going to ask Chuck one question, then we're going to turn to the audience. So feel free to get cue for mics. Chuck, I want to ask you to do a reality check.
Good Lord.
It's Aspen.
you're the former CEO. You've sat in that chair. CK is calling for, it's time for that dialogue. It is time for not a CEO, but a group of CEOs to catalyze it. Ben's acknowledging that it's not a public-private partnership, but it is the time for the public sector, the private sector, to explicitly work together. Is it practical? Can it be done?
Well, the short answer is, of course, it can be done. Is it likely to be done, if I can rephrase your question? I think the answer is probably no. I think that if you prioritize issues, as I said, when I talked at the outset, I think that the dislocation issue, the is actually the smaller issue of the two that I mentioned. I think the new equilibrium between the developed countries and the developing countries is actually far more important with respect to those who disagree than the dislocation. I know that when you are a CEO and you're sitting in that chair, you are dealing constantly with crisis situations. Everything that can be solved by anybody else gets solved by somebody else. And the only thing that comes to you are things that cannot be solved by anybody else. And frankly, whether the severance policy should be more or less, whether the early retirement policy should be more or less, whether the CEO should reach out to his or her counterparts and try to come up with that's way down the list of things that are on fire. And so can it be done? Sure. But like most things in life, you tend to muddle through things. And it takes a crisis, really, to crystallize activities. And I frankly don't think it's at that level. And again, if I had to recommend to a policymaker or the next president or something, boy, I'd sure focus a lot more on what the new equilibrium is between us and China, and the new equilibrium between the United States and India and Brazil and Russia. I think those are dramatic and potentially traumatic issues to deal with.
Say more about what you mean.
More.
About the disequilibrium and what it results in.
I think that most of us grew up in the post-World War II era when the United States had a unique position in the world, a unique position perhaps in history, having taken over large parts of the British Empire, having the only intact manufacturing base, blah, 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 blah. That's changed. That's not the case anymore. And globalization has empowered China, has empowered India, has empowered Brazil, in ways that no one who lives there ever experienced before. And it has empowered Russia in an energy sense in the last few years in ways that they remembered from before. And that new sense of empowerment causes a dramatic pushback. And they don't want to hear from the American position anymore. The Japanese, do they really care about refueling the Pacific Fleet? They care about whether they're acting in concert with the United States or not. And that whole sense of disequilibrium, changing the model that was there and having to deal with people in new ways because they think of themselves differently, that's a whole different thing that has to be dealt with and is a very, very complicated thing to deal with in a political public sense.
And likely going to require a new kind of leadership, very different kind of leadership. Got a question from the floor.
Yes, one of the indirect results of globalization that troubles many of us in the consulting field, like I'm a partner with Pricewaterhouse, and I'm sure Beth has the same concern with EY, is the ability of multinational corporations to park profits in certain low tax jurisdictions by taking advantage of transfer pricing. And this not only affects the economies in which they are operating, because they're not paying, a fair share of tax is not paid in those economies, but also the funds then are not brought back into the United States in a way that can help the capital build up in this country. And this is one of the things that I wonder if it equally troubles multinational corporations in terms of the social compact that is inherent in this ability to park profits anywhere you want and not pay a fair share in jurisdictions that have provided the means to the corporations to operate effectively in those jurisdictions. And also the consultants are torn about what to do because on the one hand they are advisors to companies in minimizing global taxes, and yet they know that it is not totally an ethical way to operate. And I wonder if you have some response to that issue.
Ben, you talk about the ethical corporation.
Yeah, I think what you raise is a larger question. The tax issue is extremely hard to answer, because what's fair, what happens to U.S. companies in the international field is different than the European companies, who have their own kinds of advantages in terms of the value-added tax and no sort of international tax. So I think it's a question I can't answer today. I will say this, though. I think one of the issues for globalization over the next 30 years or 50 years, it is a long program and it's very important, is either the convergence or harmonization of commercial law, whether it's competition law, financial services law, taxation, manufacturing standards. These are product standards. These are things that people in this room don't see, but they are critical to how international companies conduct business. And the right way to do it is to have fair competition across the world and have some kind of either convergence of these laws or harmonization. But that is like making a treaty like the WTO. It is a long, complicated process that is absolutely necessary so that there is tax harmonization, so everyone is treated the same, as just an example. But even in Europe, that issue has risen and fallen. It's very hard to get people to the table to talk about that because the politics of each nation state are so unique.
And every multinational.
I agree that there should be a fair system, but there should be a fair system across all aspects of commercial activity, and that's going to be the agenda for the next 40 years.
CK, you want to comment?
Yeah, I think being accountants, you understand there is not even common accounting standards everywhere. I think globalization is going to force us to do is very soon start thinking about transnational governance mechanisms. And I think you already talked about a few. I believe the most interesting is going to be human rights and ecological standards and what you can do to ecology and the environment. How do you have to treat people? What are the human rights standards? At least those two I see as very imminent because you can't fight case by case. You can't fight Nike in Indonesia, somebody else in somewhere else, because you have to harmonize what the basic rights, human rights are, that all companies, local and global companies, will comply with. And the environmental issues is exactly the same. And third, I think, will be security of communications. Internet security needs laws that are not country by country, but transnational governance systems, because so much of the traffic and the information about individuals for multinational companies and others are going through the internet all the time. So I believe there are three or four areas where it is in the interest of the multinationals to start the dialogue on transnational governance issues and then force governments rather than let the governments take the lead, in which case it will take 10 years or maybe, if at all. So I think the global companies have to start asking themselves, what is in our public good where all of us can benefit? And I think I probably agree with Chuck that the urgent drives out the important at the CEO's desk. But having said that, at some stage you have to sit back and ask the question, how do I use my bully pulpit called the CEO's position of a global company for creating the new social compact that allows us to operate differently? So, and I also think that academics, and I can speak for academics, we have failed too to raise these issues and create salience for these issues for debate. So it's not only the role of the CEO and the politicians. I think academics have an equally important role to play in raising these issues, articulating the options, and providing a framework for people to come together.
Yeah, we are all culpable, but the need is ever apparent.
The need is very clear.
What you call for. Let's go here.
Yes, you just, CK, alluded to the issue I want to raise, which is what are the effects of globalization on the environment? And I'm thinking in particular of the mobility of capital in a globalized, that accompanies globalized commerce, and the ability of transnationals to evade local regulations that would protect the environment, but also perhaps to forget a sense of place and the importance of a community-based stewardship for the earth. And anybody can, you have partly addressed my question, but I was thinking, does the mobility of a globalized economy create special problems?
I would say that part of this whole performance and integrity concept, as I said, are global ethical standards. The company I work for said that we will build to world standards wherever we are. We will not build to the, we're not going to Mexico to build to lower standards than in Louisville, Kentucky. In fact, because we're building new plants, our plants, in fact, are better in Mexico than they are in the United States. When we're building something new in China, it's to world standards. It's not for a lot of reasons. I could go, but among them, at some point, there's less waste. It's more sensible from a business point of view, and it's more sensible from an environmental point of view. So you can have a combination of idealistic and prudential reasons to do it. I'm not saying every company does it, but I'm saying I think at least in my personal concept of what integrity involves, it is that kind of issue, exactly.
I think it's an interesting concept when the multinational culture in some way clashes with the local culture. Ben, you spoke about it in terms of corruption and what the right thing to do there
right.
is. But it goes even to things like gender. And when, you know, companies very inclusive and supportive of women, but then it clashes with a local country culture that is not supportive of women.
I don't want to preempt. I just want one thing. We discovered that there was tremendous human capital in both Japan and China because of discrimination against women. That both these societies basically have equal numbers going to university, but not equal numbers then employed after university. And so it was a tremendous opportunity to find fantastic people because of the local discrimination was created, in fact, created an opportunity.
I agree with Ben on the human capital side. On the environmental side, one of the things I think is interesting, I don't read much about this being talked about, up for the last 20, 30 years, most capital has originated in the United States or in London as it's been deployed around the world. And when most people talk about the mobility of capital, they talk about, well, we can move it from here to there and here to there and so forth. But it always originates and comes back to, not in a repatriation sense perhaps, but in a management sense, it's always come back to the States or to London. And the NGO community has been very effective in pairing off against the large corporations. And my experience has been that the top 200 or some number like that been very responsive to concerns about the environment. I'm sure people can disagree, could be more and less and so forth. But I think the point of the question might be slightly different, which is as capital now is accumulating outside of the Western world, as it's accumulating in China, it's accumulating in the Middle East and so forth, query, will the NGOs be as effective in matching up against those managers of capital as they have been in the States? You can embarrass a large company in the United States. The press will pick up on these issues and so forth. I'm not sure if that's true of a sovereign wealth fund coming out of the Middle East. If they employ capital in a particular way, which is arguably less environmentally friendly, will the natural constraints that we have enjoyed the last 20 years or so, will those continue to be employed in the same way? Or will we find, as we've read some press reports, that some investments in Africa, for example, are better taken in because they do not care so much about human rights issues? So that you could find yourself, I don't know if that's true, but I read it in the paper, you could find yourself in a situation where outside Western world pools of capital were in fact less friendly to the environment than we've been so far.
Yeah, legitimate question, legitimate concern.
You've asked part of my question already, so I'm going to expand a little bit. How much should we really expect multinationals, particularly the largest 200 multinationals, to do in the realm of the transmission of values? And isn't there a danger that this evangelism by these multinationals will actually create cultural clashes?
Well, every U.S. institution that's of size operates around the world as a U.S. institution. No one in the States can take the point of view that they would have lesser standards, whether on the environment and gender, product safety, anything, if they happen to be operating in a foreign country. It doesn't work. It's a non-starter because you are judged by U.S. standards. And the regulators, the media, everyone judges you around the world by Western standards. And that's becoming more true of Western Europe. The example of Siemens and their bribery issues and so forth. They're being judged not by standards in the developing world and certainly not by standards in Germany. They're being literally judged by the Department of Justice here in the United States. And so virtually no one does that. The clashes that come when you do that, when you have in a country which has very significant gender issues, for example, and you as a multinational insist on having what we would think of as appropriate gender standards, you create a huge a backlash among, let's say, the men. Having said that, you have an influx, a sudden dramatic influx of women managers into the institution, which advantages you compared to your local competitor. So, sure, it sets it up, but on balance, it's a very positive thing.
I would say it a little differently. I don't think it's just U.S. values. To go back to something I said at the very beginning, if integrity has sort of law, ethics, and then values, and the values are honesty, fairness, candor, reliability, and trustworthiness, I'm not sure those are American values. Those are good institutional values. And the way we tried to talk about it at GE was to say to people, let's say in China, where everyone knows family connections are a big deal, conflict of interests are ignored, the way I tried to help people talk about it was to say, look, it's not that we disrespect your local culture. If you choose to come with a global company, we need to have a global culture on certain critical things. And these are the values we've chosen, and here is why we've chosen them. So we try to explain it. We try to treat them with respect in explaining why we do it. But they are different than some of the things that you do locally. If you choose to come with us, please live by our global culture. But if you don't, we understand, and we don't disrespect your local culture. I think I view it a little bit more that way, Chuck, than it's a U.S. set of values. And I think we found that to be a reasonably effective way of communicating these things because, as I said before, one of the problems which Siemens had, actually the law had changed so that it was against the law in Germany, but they had decentralized their culture. I mean, I don't want to get too businessy, but it's a pretty important concept for big global institutions. They basically had left to the regional and country managers how they enforced the Siemens public corporate policy against bribery. And what they did was they basically didn't enforce it. They went with the local custom, which was often to bribe, and they've gotten in terrible trouble. Mm. And so that's why on all these critical issues, you really do need sort of this uniform global culture, which is not just U.S.
I think U.S. companies may be at the forefront of enforcing these values, but I do not think I agree with my colleague here. You should not think of it as U.S. values. They're universal values if you want to grow your organization and make it inclusive so that large number of people can participate in a transparent way in building your company. If you look at the first set of companies which made all people inclusive in their senior management, they were American companies. So they had to learn how to do this. And, of course, American values helped an enormous deal, and the pressures inside America helped them also to make it applicable across the world. So I see large Indian companies trying to become global. Their values are not any different from GE or Citibank.
Right. Could I just say one other thing, because I think this audience would be very interested in it. You do have to deal with these cultural differences. One of the most important things that any organization can have is what I call employee voice, where people are free to speak out, an ombuds system, among other things. If you're in Europe, you've had the Gestapo, the Stasi, you have terrible examples of where sort of informing systems have been grotesquely misused. So you have an enormous challenge to explain to people that it's going to be fair, it's going to be prompt, it's not going to go, it'll go up and down wherever the facts lead. So you have to accept these things and try to explain their importance given cultural histories. And a lot of the success is by finding local people who embrace the values, not the foreigners, and who want to live those values and can explain to their colleagues that it works. But that's a really good example, I think, of a case where you have to deal with local culture, which for very powerful and important reasons is at least instinctively against an ombuds system.
Absolutely. Fundamental to globalization. Let's go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate your addressing the questions both in terms of the broader social context and the influences from employees and that sort of thing. But it seems to me that much of the pressure on corporate culture has to do with the investor. And I'm curious about the best mechanisms or forums for engaging not only folks in the U.S. and many of us who are both consumer and investor now, but what are the best instances that you've seen of influencing the flow of capital and investment based on the values that you're talking about?
One word, scandal. Increasingly, not just the NGO investors, socially responsible investors, but the investment community is looking at risk. And so because we've discovered one of the things that's changed in the last 15 years is that the consequences of misses in any of these areas are very serious to catastrophic. Yeah. And so now the investors are building into their analyses the degree to which companies have the kinds of systems for prevention, integrity, and so forth. It's not universal. It's not happening all the time. But I think the trend, to some extent, is there because there is a real negative side to having these things not work well that infect the business in very profound ways. And so I think that's the way you do it. And all you have to do is pick up the newspapers, both in the United States and Europe. And these scandals now are really of catastrophic dimensions.
I think what we're also seeing is that the enlightened corporate leaders of the 21st century understand this need to engage with stakeholders and not just shareholders. And as they engage with stakeholders, what I'm seeing is them evaluate risks very differently. They understand a much broader spectrum of reputational risks and operational risks.
Just a quick follow-up, because so much of the investors' measure of success still does tie to quarterly gains. So that seems true to me, but it doesn't seem to have much by way of persuasion. And I'm just curious about more persuasive or, sort of quantifiable and
actual. I think
and
one
actual
of the great myths, though, is that there is something called the investor or the shareholder. There are many different kinds of investors. There are people who do go short. There are the arbitrageurs. There's the little man and women living in Iowa. I mean, you know, people are trying to make a buck in the market, and so they do it in all sorts of ways, and I defer to Chuck and CK, but I just think that we cannot generalize about investors, and that's part of the problem here. There are a lot of people putting a lot of pressure on short term. There are a lot of other people who invest. You know, look at Mr. Buffett. I mean, he's someone who has a completely different philosophy and has done okay. I don't think you can generalize about investors except to say there is no question there is a lot of short-term pressure.
We're running short on time. We've got two questions in the queue. Okay. So let's go here and then here, and we'll keep our answers brief, and then we'll conclude. Okay.
One of my primary concerns in the debate about globalization, I think it is the bottom billion that we've been talking about. And so if we were to view globalization as kind of a rising tide that lifts all boats, that's only good news if you have a boat. And so that means that leaves a lot of people with the prospect of drowning. And so as we talk about, in some ways, a revolution for people to green their efforts towards development, I wonder how we see ourselves doing that and why people would listen to us after we've contributed so much to the degradation of the environment and the planet to get to where we've gotten to. And so I was wondering if you guys could speak to that.
No, but I think now that the planet is degraded quite substantially, I think we can say we have learned quite a lot of lessons, and now it's time to reform and make a change. I think one of the things that is very fascinating for me is if we really understand globalization, how we can help people responsibly, even the poorest of the poor, to participate in globalization. I'll give a 30-second example. The largest hand-knitted carpet facility in the world is in India. They import wool from Australia, New Zealand, China, and Argentina, and silk from China. They weave it, and they finish it, and they sell it all in the United States. But the entire weaving, cleaning of the wool, weaving, spinning, finishing, everything is done in a highly decentralized fashion by totally uneducated women in Indian villages. So here is a global supply chain of wool coming from China and Australia and New Zealand, blended with Rajasthani wool, decentralized spinning and weaving, making the best carpets that all of us would be proud to have at home, and the entire market is here. That means we have to involve people in capability building, and this business is growing like crazy. So I think it is possible to involve people, and this institution is not only training people, getting women involved, teaching them new skills, but making sure that it is as green as it can get. So, and it is totally computer-aided, and they've built a computer network, so all women can participate in figuring out how much they will earn based on what the production is. So these things are possible to do. I believe we are only limited by our imagination, and we have to break the old molds of how to do business. And I think if we can build new business models, we can get everybody in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America to participate in the benefits of globalization. And I sound too optimistic. And I work on the ground, and I see these case studies, and I see these people changing. The last thing I would say is, globalization will not work long term if we not just ignore women, and gender issues is not only at the management level. Women must become an integral part of the development process in the village. If you don't do it, in other words, I say an educated woman is an educated family. An educated man may not mean much. And I think...
Glad you said that.
No, but I think it is true. An educated man maybe get a good job, but an educated woman will... Just think about the history of the United States. The unwritten story of women who kept their families together, taught their kids in the Wild West. And you don't hear that. You hear of the cowboys. And I worry about how under these harsh conditions, did they keep the families together. It's fascinating. So the same thing is happening in the poor countries.
Economic empowerment of women is a huge force. Last question.
The tax question that was raised by the gentleman from Ernst & Young.
It was from Pricewaterhouse.
Pardon?
I pay attention to those things.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. The bills are less. Your response, Mr. Heineman, concerns me for several reasons, and I'd appreciate it if you have something else to say on this and if other members of the panel do. Perhaps two of the reasons that I think it needs to be dealt with now is, one, the leadership that you have pointed out that American multinationals should exhibit, and secondly, I think if there is not leadership on the part of American internationals, there will be leadership on the part of the political process. We've all read great attention to these issues now, and it's my feeling that if they're not dealt with on a corporate level, they will be dealt with on a political level.
I think it's a fair comment, and I wasn't trying to defend the status quo. I was just talking about a broader set of commercial issues. On the tax issues, I really think that sometimes we may overstate the role of companies. I mean, these go to the very nature of sovereignty, of how do you raise revenue and taxes to pay for things. And so getting the EU to cooperate amongst itself to have harmonization, let alone getting the EU and the U.S., getting alone the EU and the U.S. with the Asian countries to do sort of international tax reform, is an enormous task, which I'm not sure companies by themselves can do, given all their other priorities right now. I don't gainsay the issue. It's important. It's a very important issue. It'd be something to work on. But you've got to remember the sovereign nature of taxing and how difficult that is to change. That would be my only comment. I don't disagree.
And I would, with great respect, I would disagree with the premise of your question. Taxation is not one of the great verities of life. Taxation is a set of rules that Congress has enacted. And the notion of transfer pricing, there's no major company that doesn't have ongoing battles with the IRS over the level of transfer pricing. So it's not as if the companies do it and they should do better. There's a constant battle over what transfer pricing is. And no yearly audit can close unless the IRS accepts what the transfer pricing is. Repatriation of profits. This is all driven by the rules of the IRS. It's a rule book. This is not life and truth and justice. There's a rule book. And people play by the rules. And if people want the rules to be changed, change the rules. But I would, with great respect, disagree that there is an ultimate verity that has to be enabled by corporations when it comes to tax policy. You know, this is, pardon me for saying it this way, write your congressman. You know, there's a set of rules that people play by. You can change the rules anytime you want to, and God knows Congress changes the rules all the time. But I think to say, well, the tax rate's 30%, but gee, you know, you really ought to pay 40. That's the right thing to do. I think that's the wrong way to think
but
about
Chuck,
tax
would you
policy.
Disagree that we could have a harmonized tax system that might be better for global competition?
There's no question about that. But in terms of our companies doing, quote, the right thing, I think, again, with great respect, I disagree with the premise of the question. Globalization will be much better. Companies, people will be much better if there is harmonization rather than competition among tax policies.
Very well said. You know, and the U.S. used to enjoy one of the lowest corporate tax rates in the world and now is the second highest tax rate in the world. So the need for harmonization is clearly apparent. Let me ask you to join me in thanking this panel for an outstanding discussion.